and welcome to today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, April 25th, 2024. I am your reader, Martha Avery, and here is our first of three stories from the front page. WITCC reaches student settlement. Students from Chile likened internships to human traffic. Western Iowa Tech Community College's Board of Directors has approved a $3 million settlement agreement of a federal lawsuit filed by 13 students from Chile who had alleged the school lied to them about an internship program. The students likened the program to forced labor and human trafficking, saying in their lawsuit they were forced to work up to 50 hours a week and were left little time to attend class, study, or sleep. During a brief special meeting Wednesday, the Sioux City College's Board of Directors voted unanimously to approve the settlement after meeting in closed session with its attorney. While the college strongly denies any liability, this is a business decision, Board Vice President Tricia Sutherland said at the conclusion of the meeting, which was conducted via video conference. We appreciate the board's decisive action and are pleased to have this matter resolved, WITCC President Terry Morrell said in a news release sent out by the college shortly after the meeting concluded. The students were recruited to WITCC through the federal J-1 student study program and said that they were promised they'd be in a two-year degree program in culinary arts or robotics and receive a scholarship covering tuition and housing, school-covered meals, and internships in their field of study. Instead, they said they were forced to work physically demanding jobs in two local factories, often in long overnight shifts. The settlement, a result of mediation earlier this month, is not an admission of liability, said the college's attorney, Scott Brennan of Des Moines. The settlement will allow WITC to focus on its mission. The college's focus is on educating students rather than defending itself against lawsuits, Brennan said. Benjamin Bergman, a Des Moines attorney representing the students, said he could not comment on the settlement because of ongoing litigation in the lawsuit. WITCC acknowledged the J-1 visa program did not live up to the college's standards. The news release said all students in the program were free to leave at any time, and the college offered each one a plane ticket home when the COVID-19 pandemic began. Brennan said 10 of the 13 students remain in the United States, but he was unsure if any continue to live in Sioux City. The students filed their lawsuit in November of 2020 against WITC, Merle, and other WITC officials, plus Turpac Foods, Royal Canin USA, and Premier Services, also known as J&L Staffing and Recruiting and J&L Enterprises. Nancy Albrecht of Premier Services and four Chilean citizens who helped recruit the students for the program in their home country. The students accused all defendants of human trafficking, forced labor, debt, bondage, racketeering, conspiracy, fraud, breach of contract, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. A judge later dismissed the racketeering claim. The lawsuit will continue against the remaining defendants. Trial is scheduled for October 7th in U.S. District Court in Sioux City. A similar lawsuit filed by Brazilian students who were part of the same program remains in litigation and is scheduled for trial in May 2025. In summer 2019, 60 students from Chile and Brazil arrived in Sioux City as part of a program in which they obtained J-1 visas through the U.S. Department of Study at WITCC. The visa requires that in return for a scholarship that pays tuition, housing, and other fees, students must work at an internship to gain experience in their field of study. The students enrolled in the school's culinary arts and robotics and automation programs, and through J&L, a Sioux City job placement service, many secured employment at Royal Canin, a pet food manufacturer in North Sioux City, and TruPak, a turkey processor in Sioux City. According to the lawsuit, the students were paid $15 an hour, $7.75, which was withheld from their paychecks and given to WITC as payment for their scholarships, room, and board. Some students who went public with complaints about the program in January 2020 said they were left without enough money to buy food because college had not allowed them had not followed through on meals it had promised them. In the lawsuit, the students said WITCC threatened to withhold food and housing or deport them if they missed a work shift. The lawsuit said TruPak, which closed its Sioux City plant in 2022, and Royal Canin were guaranteed workers who couldn't quit or leave out of fear of retaliation. Some students who quit their jobs were charged $250 per week for tuition, room, and board. In early 2020, Morrell and WITCC denied asking students to pay tuition and housing out of their own pockets. Morrell said a free meal plan was never promised, but pledged to develop one even though a J-1 visa program did not require it. A handful of students left the program and returned home, but the others remained under the promise of new internships. Though WITC announced all remaining students have been placed in new jobs, the students said in the lawsuit they were never placed in new internships. According to the lawsuit, WITC canceled their visas on March 13, 2020, and bought them airline tickets to go home. Later that month, WITC canceled the program, citing concerns about the spread of COVID-19. It no longer operates the program. The settlement approved Wednesday also pertains to the following WITCC officials named as defendants in the lawsuit: Terry Yee, Dean of International Education Institute; Housing Supervisor Rosanna Salgado Burright, who at the time the suit was filed was an international educational specialist; Julianne Albert, Vice President of Learning; James Zurcher, International Educational Coordinator; and Lily Castro, Director of Special Programs. Morrell said resolution of the lawsuit will have no effect on the college's current or future programs. The college's enrollment and finances are strong, and we remain focused on providing an enriching educational experience for all WITCC students. This matter will not impact or influence our programs or future plans, he said. Morningside University receives $2 million donation for School of Business. Tom Rosen has donated $2 million to Morningside University for a School of Business. Morningside University announced the gift Wednesday afternoon. Sharing the money will serve as the base funds for the design and construction of a School of Business. The new School of Business building will emerge as a hub of innovation, learning, and leadership, Morningside President Albert Mosley said. This facility will not only enhance our educational offerings, but will also serve as a vital resource for the entire Siouxland region and beyond. The new building will be located on Morningside Avenue, north of the Walker Science Center, and to the east of the Crone Center and Hickman Johnson Furrow Learning Center. Mosley hopes Rosen's gift will spur other donors to the project. After that, the next step is to begin the process of looking at renderings and designs for the new facility. Tom Rosen's generosity is not just a testament to his unwavering dedication to Morningside, but also a beacon of inspiration to the entire university community, Mosley said. His successful business career, coupled with his long-standing commitment to our university, exemplifies the very essence of leadership and philanthropy that we aspire to instill in every student who walks through our doors here at Morningside. Rosen graduated from Morningside in 1970 with a degree in business administration with minors in livestock, marketing, and history. He has a more than 20-year tenure as part of the Morningside University Board of Directors and an honorary degree from Morningside in 2017. Rosen's family business, Rosen's Diversified Inc., is a Minnesota-based company that specializes in areas such as agriculture and meatpacking. Morningside has been more than just a place of learning. It's a community that molds leaders, innovates for the future, and instills values that have guided me throughout my life and career, Rosen said in a news release. I am making this investment to give back and to help prepare the next generation of leaders. Business changes quickly, and I want to ensure Morningside can adapt to provide what students and employers need. He has made other contributions to Morningside campus through naming gifts for the Rosen-Verdon Athletics Complex, Tom Rosen Field, and Rosen Ag Center. And the third front page story is titled Bleachers Headlining Saturday in the Park. Bleachers, fronted by Grammy Award-winning singer, songwriter, musician, and producer Jack Antonoff, will be the headlining act when Saturday in the Park, SITP, returns to Grandview Park July 6. Credited for redefining pop music through his collaborations with Taylor Swift, Lana Del Rey, the 1975 and St. Vincent, Antonoff won the coveted Producer of the Year Grammy in February. It was Antonoff's third consecutive year for winning this top honor. He is only the second producer in Grammy's history to win this top honor. Antonoff's band, Bleachers, has built a huge, passionate following with their anthemic pop rock sound. The group's self-titled album, released in March, features such singles as Modern Girl, Alma Mater, and Me Before You. Mike Campbell and the Dirty Knobs, featuring longtime Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers member Mike Campbell, will also be one of the opening acts on SITP's main stage. In addition to being the Heartbreakers' lead guitarist, Campbell co-wrote many of the group's biggest hits and co-produced many of their albums. He also penned songs for Don Henley, Bob Dylan, and Stevie Nicks. Brooklyn-based pop artist Del Water Gap, best known for his hit single Ode to the Conversation Stuck in Your Throat, and South Carolina-born country singer-songwriter Nikki Lane, who is known for his outlaw Americana sound, are also main stage acts. Saturday in the Park's alternative, Abe Stage, will continue to have a diverse lineup of music on the Stone Park Boulevard side of the park with the Chicago-born Twista, a Grammy-nominated multi-platinum recording artist, as its headliner. Blues and soul group Black Joe Lewis and the Honey Bears, a veteran group that originates from Austin, Texas, and Southern rapper Paul Wall, who won a Grammy for Grills, spelled G-R-I-L-L-Z, a duo he performed with Nelly. Additional acts for both main stage and the Abe stage will be announced when they become available. founded in 1991 by Dave Bernstein and Adam Friegs, Saturday in the Park continues to be free to the public. It will run from noon to 10:30 p.m. July 6th, annually drawing in more than 25,000 people on the 4th of July weekend. Saturday in the Park also features Arts Alley, a kids zone, and an abundance of festival food. It will conclude with a fireworks show immediately following the bleachers. This is from the Star Tribune, Minneapolis. New website aims to revolutionize philanthropy. A Minnesota nonprofit leader hopes to revolutionize charitable giving with a new platform for people to trade household items they no longer need, resulting in a donation to a nonprofit. Think Buy Nothing meets GoFundMe. Joel Ackerman, a former United Health Group Information Technologies executive who worked at numerous startups, was inspired by a Canadian man in 2005 who got international attention after trading a red paperclip for progressively more expensive items until he landed a house in a trade. He essentially created money out of a paperclip. He got a house, Ackerman said. He mimics that concept in his new Red Ladder platform, but with a charitable twist. Red Ladder, which will be publicly unveiled May 1st, is an online marketplace for people to trade items they no longer need, from a vintage guitar and jewelry to a refrigerator and foosball table. One person donates an item, and another person can get it by trading in a higher-priced item, and so on. The trade sequence, or ladder, ends with Red Ladder selling an item and donating the cash proceeds to a charity designated by the initial donor. Not only is it keeping stuff out of the landfills, it's helping build a charitable organization, Ackerman said. It is actually creating new money for philanthropy. The platform taps into the growing sustainability movement of reducing waste, like Buy Nothing groups, where people offer up their unneeded items for free, from furniture to knickknacks. It also comes at a critical time for nonprofits facing rising expenses and declining donations, struggling to find new ways to drum up revenue to fill the financial gaps. Nonprofits are grappling with donor fatigue and decreasing corporate giving. In a survey last fall by the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, a third of the respondents reported that donations and foundation grants have declined. Individual giving decreased in 2022 by 6.4%, with Minnesotans donating $5.3 billion, falling closer to pre-pandemic levels, according to the Minnesota Council of Foundations. It seems to be a shrinking pool of money that doesn't have a solution in sight, Ackerman said. Donors don't want to attend another gala. We need to find a way to energize and add fuel into the whole philanthropic ecosystem. Red Ladder offers a new angle on digital fundraising, Ackerman said, by trading items for free. It's a great experiment. No one has done this before, Ackerman said. We're leveraging technology in an innovative way to do something good for society. Since soft launching in February, Red Ladder donations have added about 100 items worth at least $20 that will benefit 31 churches and nonprofits. So far, none of the ladders has closed out to donate to a nonprofit, but Ackerman said he hopes the number of items, trains, and donations will increase starting in May. He said he's using artificial intelligence, AI, to help assess when to close a trade ladder, with Red Ladder selling the item. Ackerman is running Red Ladder by himself as a volunteer, part of a nonprofit he started a few years ago. Ackerman is paying the fees and costs to run Red Ladder out of his own pocket, he said, because he hopes to eventually draw a salary and pay for employees with a portion of the trade sales. Caring Bridge, the Bloomington, Minnesota-based Free Health Journal website, encouraged its employees to use Red Ladder. At Caring Bridge, where Ackerman was a former board member, about a dozen employees have donated items. From the business page, here's one about Sioux Honey Business. Sioux Honey Association puts its old sign, newly refurbished, back on the building. The iconic sign on the corner of Sioux Honey Association's plant has returned, newly refurbished and changed slightly. The logo, long associated with the co-op's Sioux Bee line, was removed from the northeast side of the building at the intersection of 6th Street and Lewis Boulevard in the summer of 2020. For a time, it was replaced with canvas-type signage depicting the Honey's cooperative products. Versions of the Sioux Bee logo have been displayed on the plant since it opened in 1970. The logo, removed 4 years ago, featured a caricature of a young Native American girl with stylized feather in her hair and bee wings next to a globe. The refurbished sign is largely the same, except the feather has been removed. The decision to bring back the logo comes from a desire to honor Sioux Honey's co-op's rich history, which dates back to when it was formed by 5 Sioux City beekeepers in 1921. The company said in a statement, after recent successful rebrandings of our Sioux Bee honey bottles by emphasizing our brands and cooperative, we felt this was also a great time to focus on the heritage of our company. Sioux Honey sees it as an honorable gesture to recognize the company's roots and the integral role the logo played in our early branding. The new sign was put in place within the last week or so. Sioux Honey President Emeritus Mark Mammon said, "We changed our marketing scheme, probably 5, 6, 7 years ago, to where we're emphasizing our brand and the fact that we're a co-op, which unfortunately a lot of people didn't realize," Mammon said. "So we really went in a different direction. So we actually put up the other display for a while, and we refurbished this old sign." At the time the old logo was removed in 2020, Mammon noted the co-op had moved away from the logo on its consumer products several years before. He also emphasized the co-op was not acting on outside pressures when it removed the sign. "There wasn't anything external. It was just a new direction that we've been trying to take," he said in 2020. From shopping bags to sleeping mats, Sioux City Group makes the mats out of plastic bags. For many people, there is a never-ending supply of plastic shopping bags in their homes. Now there's a way to put those plastic bags to use while helping the unsheltered in the community. Looming Matters, based in the Grace United Methodist Church, has started making sleeping mats out of donated shopping bags in Sioux City. Each mat utilizes between 700 and 800 plastic shopping bags, keeping them out of landfills and providing a comfortable dry mat for the unsheltered to utilize. "People are happy to give you their plastic bags," said Kathy Martin, a retired pastor. During a mission trip to Jefferson, Iowa, Grace Methodist members learned about this project from Midwest Mission. The mats can be used for the unhoused in the community as well as shipped throughout the country, especially to places that are experiencing natural disasters. Grace United does not distribute the mats. Currently, they are working to partner with organizations throughout the community that will be able to distribute them. The Siouxland Soup Kitchen is one of those organizations. Martin said. The process of making the mats is fairly simple. Each loom is handmade for this specific purpose. The top and bottom of the bags are cut off, and the remaining strips are woven, similar to the way woven potholders are made. The mats are tightly woven because many people will use them on the ground. We want to keep moisture away from their bodies, she said. Not all bags are made equal, varying in size and thickness. Martin said that the more mats people work on, the more preferences they develop. High-quality bags, such as Menards, are in high demand, as well as colored bags. Despite the differences, Martin said any plastic bag will work. We'll use them all, even the ones that are kind of thin, she said. No part of the bags go to waste. Martin said the parts of the bags that are cut off go to a company, Trex, T-R-E-X, that turns the plastic into park benches. Since starting the project in October, Looming Matters has made 15 mats. The goal is to provide the mats to organizations in the community that can provide them to people who need them. So far, they have given a few mats to the food pantry and hope to expand. One of the mat makers said they believe in sharing the love of God with people throughout the world and hope that those who receive the mats know that they were made by someone who cares for them. During worship, the congregation prays over the mats. The group makes mats from 10:30 a.m. on Mondays, 1 p.m. on Tuesdays, and at 9 a.m. on Sundays. Martin said anyone is welcome to join in. She said it is a great time to socialize and the process is simple enough to hold conversation while looming. It's a very fun way to get together to talk and yet do some good for some people, Martin said. Questions about making the mats and where to donate plastic bags can be directed to Martin at gmakmart@gmail.com. You are listening to the Sioux City Journal on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Readings Information Service for the Blind. All the material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I am your reader, Martha Avery. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we will turn to today's obituaries. There are seven people listed today. Casey Glenda, 70, of Sioux Falls. Glenda Casey, 70, of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Joyce Harrison, 89, of Sioux City. Madonna Manning, of Burrisford, South Dakota. Marianne Miller, 87, of Sioux City. David Bickhinke, 86 of Storm Lake, Iowa. Patricia Porter, 77, of South Sioux City, Nebraska. And Bonnie Welch, 78, of Sioux City. Madonna Esther Manning. Madonna Esther Nordquist, maiden name Manning, passed away peacefully on April 20th, 2024. Her seven children survive her. A mass of Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, April 27th, 2024, at St. Teresa's Catholic Church in Burrsville, South Dakota. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday at the church with a rosary at 6:45 p.m. and prayer service at 7 p.m. Glenda Lorraine Casey, maiden name Rosemeyer. Glenda Lorraine Casey passed away on April 9, 2024 in Sioux Falls, South Dakota at the age of 70. Glenda was born on April 7, 1954 in Sioux City to the late Lorraine and Glenn Rosemeyer. She was preceded in death by her parents as well as her brothers William Rodney, David, and sister Clyda. Glenda was known for her sense of humor as well as her giving and compassionate nature. She touched many lives through her career as a registered nurse, graduating from Western Iowa Tech. Her dedication to caring for others extended beyond her professional life as she found joy in spoiling her grandsons and spending quality time with her family. Private family services will be held to honor Glenda's life, with Roots Funeral Home in Brookings, South Dakota, is assisting with the arrangements. Marianne Miller. Marianne Miller was born to William and Mary Dices on May 26, 1936, in Sioux City and raised in Anthon, Iowa. She passed away on April 21, 2024. A funeral mass will take place at 10 a.m. on Saturday, April 27th at St. Joseph's Catholic Church. Marianne has been cremated, and her remains will be buried next to her husband, Leo, immediately following the mass at St. Joseph's Catholic Church. Marianne graduated from Helen High School in 1955 and was also Helen's May Queen that year. After high school, she worked at the Capitol Theater in Sioux City and then provided daycare for several families. She is survived by three of her children, two stepdaughters, and grandchildren. The family would like to thank Tyler and everyone else at hospice for their amazing thoughtfulness and care of their mother. They are truly angels on this earth. David J. Pickhinke, age 86, of Storm Lake, died Friday, April 19th, 2024, at Methodist Manor Retirement Community in Storm Lake. A funeral mass will take place at 10:30 a.m. Friday, April 26th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Storm Lake. Burial will follow in the St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery. Visitation is held from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, April 25th, with a rosary at 4 p.m. at the Fratzi and Jensen Funeral Home in Storm Lake. David Joseph Pickhinke was born October 28, 1937, in Howells, Nebraska, to Frank and Otilda Pickhinke. He was 2 years old when he moved to Early, Iowa with his family, while his mother, Tilly, said he cried the whole way. He attended Sacred Heart School in Early and graduated in 1956. David served in the National Guard and Reserves from 1959 to 1964. David married Jean Teniger on September 1, 1962, in Remsen, Iowa. They raised their family of four children. David retired from farming in 2003 and moved to Storm Lake, where he enjoyed retirement while helping his two of his sons, Steve and Russ, on the farm. David was a member of the Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Early until moving to Storm Lake, where he has been a member of the St. Mary's Catholic Church. Throughout his life, David was active in his community, serving on the Early Elevator Board, Church Funeral Dinner Committee, and assisted with Early Bingo. Fishing with his family brought David joy. He had successfully taught all his grandchildren to play cards, maybe a little too well since they have won a game or two. One of his favorite sayings was, "No friends in a card game." He loved polka music and going dancing with Jean. For many years, David was part of an antique tractor pulling group in which he pulled with his 1938 John Deere G. David took many memorable trips, including traveling to the Holy Land, China, Egypt, Hawaii, Vegas, Greece, Turkey, and a bus trip to California and Texas. Bonnie Sue Welch. Bonnie Sue Welch, 78, passed away on April 23, 2024, surrounded by her family at a local nursing home after a brave battle with two types of cancer. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, April 27th at Buchanan Avenue Baptist Church with Pastor Jonathan Isley officiating. A visitation will be 1 hour prior to services. Her final resting place will be Memorial Park Cemetery. Bonnie was born on July 19th, 1945, to Donald and Enid Bagley in Sioux City. She was a member of the Central High School class of 1963 in Sioux City. That same year, on September 26, Bonnie married Ken Welch, Sr. They had three children, Kristen, Ken, and Rebecca. They were together for 24 years. During their marriage, the couple lived in California and Washington State while Ken served in the U.S. Navy before moving back to Sioux City. Bonnie worked at Countryside Nursing Home for 35 years, first as a CNA and then restorative therapist for the last 14 years before her retirement. She was a faithful member of the Buchanan Avenue Baptist Church. She was a helper there in the cleaning crew. Previously, she'd been a member of the Billy Sunday Memorial Tabernacle, where she had taught Sunday school and was president of the Ladies Missionary. Bonnie made no secret of her faith and the strength she knew came from her Savior. Her heart was always in prayer that everyone would know her Savior too. In her spare time, Bonnie enjoyed anything involving her family, including sewing clothes. Her favorite things to make were pajamas for her grandchildren, burp rags, and new dresses for her granddaughter's birthday. She loved to host theme parties for her grandchildren to celebrate all of the holidays. Even as the grandchildren grew older, they all wanted to attend Grandma B's parties. Patricia or Trish Porter. Patricia Porter, 77, of South Sioux City, Nebraska, passed away on Sunday, April 21st, 2024, at a local nursing facility. A memorial service will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, April 27th, at First Lutheran Church of South Sioux City, with Reverend Patty Meyer officiating. Burial will follow at the Omaha Valley Cemetery, rural Homer, Nebraska. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, April 26th, at the church, with family being present beginning at 4 p.m. Trish was born on March 15th, 1947, in Sioux City. She was lovingly accepted into the hands and hearts of Kenneth and Eileen Moore. Trish attended school in South Sioux City and graduated in 1965. She attended Doan College in Crete, Nebraska, graduating with a Bachelor of Arts degree in elementary education. Trish married Robert or Bob Porter on July 12, 1969, at First Lutheran Church in South Sioux City. She began teaching in 1969 in Sioux City, where she taught for 3 years. In 1972, Trish quit teaching, and Bob and Trish welcomed their first son, Brent. She became a stay-at-home mom, and in 1975, they welcomed their second son, Rob. Raising her sons with Bob and their beliefs were paramount to her. She did not return to teaching full-time until she went to Homer, Nebraska, where she retired after 29 years of teaching. Joyce E. Harrison, Sioux City. Joyce E. Harrison, 89, of Sioux City in Kingsley, Iowa, died Tuesday, April 23, 2024. Funeral at 11 a.m. Monday, April 29th, at Road Funeral Home, Kingsley. Burial, Kingsley Cemetery. Visitation at 5 p.m. The funeral home Sunday, with a 7 p.m. time of sharing memories. And now from the opinion page. Military aid helps defend democracy. Votes for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan show Congress can work together for global good. The capitals of four democracies were strengthened Saturday when the U.S. House finally passed long-stalled foreign aid bills. The three overseas capitals, Kyiv, Jerusalem, and Taipei, were boosted by a $95 billion invested in security for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. But just as consequently, the capital of our country, Washington, D.C., was strengthened by bipartisan legislation led by House Speaker Mike Johnson, who risked his role to do the right thing. Accordingly, just as most Democratic House members had his back on the aid bills, members of both parties should reject Republican extremists who threatened to topple him for doing what the U.S. and until recently Republicans have long done, be a beacon for democracies in their enduring struggle against autocracy. Johnson wasn't an early convert. He had to be convinced, particularly on the most immediate need, the $60.8 billion to aid Ukraine's fight against Russia. The speaker reportedly listened to seasoned, reasoned voices such as CIA Director William Burns, who used intelligence estimates to show Ukraine's growing military disadvantage, as well as the specter that Russians' revanchism wouldn't stop at Ukraine's borders. "I really do believe the intel," Johnson told reporters in Washington last week. "I think that Russian President Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed. I think he might go to the Baltics next. I think he might have a showdown with Poland or one of our NATO allies. If so, that would draw this country into direct conflict with Russia," which is why NATO Secretary General Hans Stoltenberg was right to tell the PBS NewsHour after the vote that the aid is not charity. "Military support for Ukraine is an investment in our own security and is an investment in U.S. security." Fortunately, every Democrat who voted on Saturday agreed. Unfortunately, 112 of the 214 Republican representatives voted no. Many came of political age in an era of Republican reverence for Reagan-era resolve against Soviet expansion. But when it came to Russia's invasion against a sovereign nation, their votes aligned more with Marjorie Taylor Greene, the former QAnon conspiracy theorist and current Georgia Republican representative who's leading the effort to force out Johnson. Tehran, Moscow, and Beijing are three capitals of authoritarian nations that were weakened by Saturday's vote. And while approving aid in no way guarantees victory or even protection for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, failure to pass these aid bills would have sent a signal far beyond any of these capitals. That includes Washington, where House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said on Saturday, "House Democrats have risen to the occasion. President Joe Biden has risen to the occasion. Traditional conservatives led by Speaker Mike Johnson have risen to the occasion." For his part, Johnson said accurately, "I think we did our work here, and I think history will judge it well." Another article from the opinion page, this is Caitlin Clark, "Paltry $76,000 pay shows players deserve more." This is by Leonard Green. Before we launch a GoFundMe page for Caitlin Clark, who will make a comparatively paltry $76,535 as a WNBA rookie this season, consider that the basketball phenom is poised to sign an eight-figure endorsement deal with Nike that will include her own signature shoe. Caitlin Clark will be just fine. it's the other women's basketball players we should be worried about. Remember, the WNBA, the Women's National Basketball Association, basketball, is the same league that features Phoenix Mercury star Brittany Griner, who in 2022 spent nearly 300 days in a Russian jail after being wrongly detained on trumped-up drug smuggling charges. The only reason Griner was even in Russia was because she couldn't make enough money playing the game she loves in her own country, and she is one of the higher-paid players. How bad is the WNBA's starting salary? Yahoo Sports just posted a job on LinkedIn that pays almost as much as $73,000 to start to post about the NBA and the WNBA on social media. Clark's contract has predictably sparked discussion and debate over pay equity and the ever-growing gender gap. Even President Joe Biden weighed in on the controversy, calling for women to be paid what they deserve. Women in sports continue to push new boundaries and inspire us all, the president posted on his X account. But right now, we're seeing that even if you're the best, women are not paid their fair share. It's time that we give our daughters the same opportunities as our sons and ensure women are paid what they deserve. Clark will pocket $338,000 plus over 4 years under her contract with the WNBA's Indiana Fever. In contrast, last year, number one NBA draft pick, 7'4" Victor Wembanyama secured a $55 million 4 year contract. In fact, the NBA's lowest paid player, Mohamed Gueye of the Atlanta Hawks, makes a little more than $1.1 million, a sum that still dwarfs most WNBA salaries. Steph Curry makes more per game than what Caitlin Clark is making for 4 years. Journalist Lisa Ling wrote on Instagram, with the toll sports and travel take on women's bodies, is this even a living wage? Of course, Clark should be making more. As a legend at the University of Iowa, Clark made history at the NCAA's Division I all-time leading scorer. More important, her play has increased interest and viewership of the game. Her first-round pick helped to drive a 304% increase in viewership for the WNBA draft this week, shattering previous rating records with 2.46 million viewers on ESPN. But paying women basketball players what they deserve doesn't mean paying them what men make. And it's not sexist to say so. Neither is it sexist to say that most men and women prefer to watch the NBA. Comparing what women WNBA players make to NBA salaries is like comparing apples and the tractor trailer parts. The name of the game is revenue, and the men's game generates much more of it. The WNBA has a TV contract worth $60 million. The NBA's contract is worth $2.7 billion. How much bigger is that? It's like standing Wembanyama next to Dawn Staley. Staley just won her third national title as coach of the University of South Carolina, beating Clark and the University of Iowa in a game that drew 18.9 million viewers, the most watched women's basketball game of all time. Caitlin Clark is the sole reason why viewership has shot through the roof for our game, the sole reason, Staley said. That's high praise from a woman who is already in the Basketball Hall of Fame. Clark's presence in the game has been a slam dunk, which appears to be the only thing she can't do. Let's have a quick look at the weather, 5-day forecast, before we add a little sports. Today, a thunderstorm wind is southeast, 12 to 25, with a high miles per hour, with a high today of 70. Tonight, the low will be 54, and you can expect shower and thunderstorms and similar winds. Friday, thunderstorms, some severe, wind southeast at 12 to 25 miles per hour, with a high of 65 on Friday and a low of 55. It's only 10 degrees difference. On Saturday, mostly cloudy, less wind, west 6 to 12 miles per hour. The high Saturday will be 70 with a low of 56. And Sunday, it's a shower and thunderstorm with wind 10 to 20 miles per hour, 62 degree high and 42 degree low. And on Monday, low clouds may break, and the high temperature is 62 and the low temperature is 44. Okay, the Muskies sweep Stars. Sioux City set on Western Conference Finals. With 3:19 gone in overtime, Ty Hansen saw a loose puck around center ice. I saw there was no one really around it. I took a step up on it and just beat the D wide and shot it over the goalie's shoulder, the defenseman said. Hansen's goal lifted the Sioux City Musketeers to a 3-2 win over the Lincoln Stars in a sweep of the best-of-five conference semifinal series. The Muskies advanced to the USHL Western Conference Finals for the second time in 3 years. After finding the back of the net, Hansen skated to center and slid on his knees as his teammates mobbed their captain and the jubilant fans at the Tyson Event Center joined in the celebration. "Feels great," Hansen said. "It's been a full team effort this whole series. It's the first step to where we want to get to. We're not done yet." The Musketeers move on to play the winner of the Fargo Force Tri-City Storm Series. Fargo, the top seed, won 3-1 Monday to take a 2-0 lead in the series. The Force looked to sweep in Game 3 Wednesday night in Kearney, Nebraska. After finding the back of the net, Hansen skated to center and slid on his knees. The Musketeers players mobbed their team captain and the jubilant fans at the Tyson Event Center joined in the celebration. Sioux City head coach Jason Kirshner said Hansen has a knack for rising up in big moments and making big-time plays. "If anybody deserves to score the walk-off goal in the Tyson Event Center, it's him," Kirshner said of the Hermantown, Minnesota native. "He's the ultimate competitor, and for me, he's the best player in the league. We're just fortunate to have him on our side, and I'm just so happy for him." Hansen, a Minnesota Duluth recruit, scored the final goal in the Musketeers' 3-2 win in the Game 2 at Lincoln and contributed an assist in the team's 3-2 victory in Game 1 at the Icebox. Despite being the number 2 seed in the Western Conference, the Muskies had to go on the road for the first 2 games because the Tyson Event Center was not available due to the Becker Shrine Circus. In their first home playoff game this season, the Musketeers got off to a strong start Monday night, taking a 1-0 lead in the Giacomo Martino goal with a 4:05 left in the first period. Sam Court and Colby Saganick assisted on Martino's snipe from the corner. Just 4 seconds into the second period, the Muskies appeared to take a 2-0 lead. Defenseman Finn Loftus gains control of a loose puck near center ice and then fired a shot into an empty net as the Stars goalie, Van Sostak, prematurely broke right. But the goal was waved off because it struck one of the officials. With 10 minutes and 37 seconds left in the second period, Sioux City officially took a 2-0 lead on a goal from forward Ethan Gardula. On a fast break, Brian Nichols fed Gardula as the Yukon recruit sped down the left edge. Hagen Burroughs was credited with the second assist. The Stars rallied to tie the game with a pair of goals that came less than a minute from each other in the second period. Defenseman Adam Klebler scored in front of the net to cut the lead to 2-1. Forward Keaton Peters then launched a slap shot that found the back of the net with 4 minutes 37 seconds left to go in the period. The game remained tied until Hansen's series winner. "It was a great game," Kirstner said. "It would have been hard for us to play much better than we did." Sioux City had a golden opportunity to win in the final minutes of regulation after two Lincoln players were called for consecutive two-minute penalties. The first came with 3 minutes 24 remaining and the second with 2 minutes 25 left, giving the Musketeers a 5-on-3 advantage for the next 1 minute and 1 second. But the Stars killed the power play with Shostak turning away multiple shot attempts. "We got some really good shots. We got some really good chances, but Shostak made some really good saves," Kirshner said. Stopped 31 of 31 attempts, while Sioux City goalie Sam Urban saved all but 2 of the Stars' 16 shots. Urban, a Arizona State recruit, picked up wins in all 3 games, stopping 30 of 31 in Game 1, 26 of 28 attempts in Game 2. "It's time of the year when you're not going to win games without great goaltending, and I thought significant of this play was how timely he was when we needed save," Kirshner said of the Slovakian native. The Musketeers advanced to the Western Conference Finals for the first time since 2022-23 season, when they went on to capture the Clark Cup.